जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राजकाचार्य अष्टोत्तर शत श्री श्रीमद अभय चरणारविंद भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी प्रभुपाद की जय। अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जय। श्री श्री गौरनिताय की जय। श्री श्री राधा वृंदावन चंद्र की जय। समवेत भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंदे हरे हरे। All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. All glories to Sri Gauranga. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्य। हरे कृष्ण। सो एज आई केम इन आई सॉ देयर इज सम पेपर्स ऑन माय टेबल। दिस इज एक्चुअली फ्रॉम मदर सिद्धि लालसा। सो आफ्टर द क्लास यू ऑल स्टे ऑन फॉर अ फ्यू मोर मिनट्स। शी विल एक्सप्लेन अबाउट दिस। She will explain to you how the course and the exams are going to be conducted and what is the objective and how those objectives can be achieved out of this Bhagavad Gita course in Bhakti Shastri, for Bhakti Shastri. And so that is, how long do you think it will take?
10 minutes.
Okay. So I can do two things. I can either finish my class 10 minutes earlier, or you all can stay 10 minutes longer. 10 minutes longer. Okay. Thank you. And I received a letter. I was wondering, who is this from? Oh, okay. I see. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. And so yesterday we did the second chapter, first 30 verses. So this beginning of the second chapter, which is entitled as the contents of the Gita summarized, is at the beginning. What did Krishna do in the first chapter? Described Arjuna's lamentation. Arjuna became affected and aggrieved seeing his very close relatives and friends are on the enemy side. And when he considered that he'll have to kill them, he became overwhelmed with grief. And he decided not to fight. Not only that he decided not to fight, but he became very much affected by his emotion, so much so that his body started to tremble and his hair stood on end, and then it has been also described that tears were flowing from his eyes. So these are not actually befitting a Kshatriya warrior. A warrior cannot afford to be weak in the battlefield. Now, Kshatriya is a person in the mode of passion, which automatically generates a tremendous power and an inclination and propensity to fight. As I was explaining yesterday, Kshatriya is like a lion. When a lion goes to kill its prey, can it afford to shed tears? Oh, the poor animal. I have to kill him. No, it's contradictory. And the situation also is contradictory. Like enemies are enemies, right? But who are his enemies here? His relatives and friends. And so when Arjuna expressed his grief in a very, very genuine and sincere way, then Krishna started to advise him, especially when Arjuna submitted himself to Krishna. That's what Krishna, Arjuna does in the second chapter, the beginning of second chapter. He surrenders himself. Says, Krishna, I am accepting you as my spiritual master, so you please instruct me. I am becoming your disciple. So here, their role is changing. Arjuna and Krishna were friends and relatives, very close relatives, they're cousins. And they were very intimate friends. But this intimate friendship now is transforming into a guru-disciple relationship. Now, in order to receive spiritual knowledge, this is the process. One must surrender to a person who has the spiritual knowledge and must receive the knowledge from that person. Even though the person may be friend, or even junior in other calculation, but if I want to receive spiritual information from them, we have to become submissive. That is the natural way to do it. That is the standard, which Krishna will explain in later on, that the way to receive spiritual knowledge is by approaching a qualified teacher in a submissive attitude and inquiring from him sincerely. So this is the way to do it. This is the way to receive spiritual knowledge. If we don't, we won't be able to receive spiritual knowledge. What to speak of spiritual knowledge? Even material knowledge. If you go to school and you think that you know better than your teacher, will you be able to learn from him? No. And especially spiritual knowledge which is not received or not a matter of intellectual transmission. It is actually a process of receiving on the basis of Shraddha, faith, respect. And that is the difference between material knowledge and spiritual knowledge. How is material knowledge acquired? Material knowledge is acquired through intellect. But spiritual knowledge is a matter of revelation. The material knowledge is received in the head, intellectually. Whereas spiritual knowledge is received in the heart. Dibya gyan hride prakashito. The transcendental knowledge is revealed in the heart. And how does that revelation take place? It takes place in the form of mercy of the spiritual master. And it is revealed in the heart. Therefore, it is imperative, it is absolutely essential that one must submit himself to the person who has this knowledge. And then upadekshanti te jnanam. And then the one who has the knowledge, he will impart it unto that person. To establish that point, here, we can see that the arrangement has been made in such a way that Arjuna is now surrendering to Krishna and accepting him as his spiritual master. Shishyasti aham, I am your disciple, He is telling Krishna, Shadhi Mang Tang Prapannam, I am surrendering unto you. I do not know what I should do. I have become completely bewildered. I do not know at a time like this what I should do. Therefore, in order to understand what I should do, I am taking shelter of you, I am surrendering unto you. This word prapanna means surrendered. It's coming from the word prapatti, which means surrender. Prapatti, surrender, and one who is surrendered, he is called prapanna. So this is by the process of surrender, one receives this knowledge. And then immediately Krishna assumed the role of a spiritual master. And he mildly chastised Arjuna. Krishna immediately assumed the role of the spiritual master and chastised Arjuna. What did he say? He said that, Arjuna, you are speaking like a wise man, but you do not have the knowledge. So, if you do not have the knowledge, but you are speaking like a wise man, what does it imply? It implies that you are a fool and you are being hypocritical. Hypocrisy means saying something without really meaning it, or without really understanding its meaning. So indirectly Krishna actually is chastising Arjuna. You are a fool. Ashochan anushochastam pragyavadanshya bhashashe. Speaking like a pragyavadan. Pragyavadan means wise words. Bhashashe means speak. You are speaking like a wise man, but you are actually lamenting over something that one should not lament about. And in this way, Krishna started to instruct Arjuna. And then Krishna pointed out to Arjuna the difference between matter and spirit. Difference between the body and the soul. So that branch, this analysis, the analytically established the difference between two substance, between two objects, is called Sankhya. So this is at this part, until this part, until the verse 30, which actually began from the 12th verse of this chapter. In this 19 verses, Krishna explained to Arjuna the difference between matter and spirit, and establish the qualities of the spirit soul. What is the soul? Before you came in contact with Srila Prabhupada's books, although you know about the soul, how many of you knew what soul is? What is the nature of the soul? What are the characteristics or qualities of the soul? How many of you knew? Okay. But after reading Srila Prabhupada's books, you got to know? How many of you got to know the qualities and characteristics of the soul? All of you. Thank you. So this is the benefit of coming in contact with a bona fide teacher, bona fide spiritual master, and his presentation. Srila Prabhupada, in such a wonderful way, presented this. Oh, I see. All this while I was speaking without. I think I was doing pretty good. So.
What happened to the cordless?
Okay. We tried to buy some cordless microphone yesterday, but couldn't find any. Anyway, we'll carry on. So, by coming in contact with Srila Prabhupada's books,
we became aware of the nature of the soul, the qualities of the soul, the characteristics of the soul. And we have understood that we are spirit souls. We are not, our actual identity is not our body. And we also understood how and why the body is alive. Body is made of matter. Matter by nature is inert. So body should have been inert, right? Matter is inert. This is what? This is matter? Is it inert or conscious? Inert. What about this? Also inert. But you? Are you inert? Why not? Your body is made of matter, but you are not inert. Why? Because of the presence of the soul in this body. Now the consideration is, who are you? Are you the body or the soul? Are you this body or the soul? Although generally we tend to think that we are our bodies, isn't it? Although we generally tend to think that we are our bodies, but when we get proper information, then we get to know that we are not this body. We are not our bodies, we are spirit souls. That's what Krishna explained at the beginning of the second chapter. So you all have become convinced that you are not your body, but you are your spirit soul. Alright? How many of you became convinced? Please raise your hands. Very good. And how many of you have realized that? I know you're very humble, so you won't say anything about that. Okay. So we'll now continue from the verse 31st onwards. Yes, Shantanu.
You were talking about Krishna chastising Arjuna and basically calling him a fool. So I was just reflecting that that seems to be an essential move for the disciple. Because there was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, actually, he was mentioning that his spiritual master called him a fool.
Yeah, he should feel like a fool, but shouldn't act like a fool. Like that he is surrendering himself, that itself is a sign of wisdom. That he is accepting a spiritual master, that itself is a sign of wisdom. But he becomes like a fool is because he understands that he doesn't have the knowledge. So he is in need of receiving this knowledge. So he actually becomes humble. And sometimes he acts on the mundane platform. Sometimes he acts in a way that he is influenced by the modes of material nature, which is quite natural. Because we are on the mundane platform. So when we are in the mundane platform, the spiritual master has the responsibility to pull us out of the platform and situate us on the spiritual platform. So that's why the spiritual master has to assume that role and bring the disciple to his right state of consciousness. So when the spiritual master sees that the disciple is acting on the mundane platform, he chastises him. When the spiritual master sees that the disciple is acting on the platform of false ego, or in the platform of distinction, adoration and profit. So he chastises him to bring him back to the spiritual platform. And when to act on a mundane platform is foolish. We are on the mundane platform. And to act on a mundane platform is foolish. So what are we? We are fools to begin with. So if somebody calls a spade, is there anything wrong in it? No. So that's what Krishna is doing. That's what a spiritual master does. And actually the spiritual master has to be very expert also. He calls a disciple fool when he knows that the disciple will be able to digest it. When he sees that the disciple is so puffed up that if he calls him a fool, he'll leave and go away. Then he waits for a little longer to bring him to the right consciousness, and then he tells him. Sometimes some devotees told me, Prabhupada never chastised him. They were very, leading devotee. He was a leading devotee. And he was very close to me also. He was one of the leaders of ISKCON at that time. And one day, rather proudly, he was telling me that Prabhupada never chastised me. And at that time I couldn't really understand. That I thought, it's very nice that he must be so advanced that Prabhupada never chastised him. But later on I realized that actually he was so puffed up. Prabhupada knew that he won't be able to accept his chastisement. That's why Prabhupada didn't chastise. On the other hand, Prabhupada was very heavy. You do a little mistake and Prabhupada would come upon you like a thunderbolt. He was so heavy. And later on we realized that it was Prabhupada's mercy that Prabhupada was chastising us. Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna. Ram Keshava.
Svadharmam api cha vekshya navikam pittum arthasi dharmyadhi yudhyas shriyodhi kshatriyasya navidyate. Considering your specific duty as a kshatriya, you should know that there is no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles. And so there is no need for hesitation.
Yes. So Kshatriya's nature is to fight. Kshatriya's nature is that he loves to fight. And that doesn't mean that a Kshatriya is quarrelsome. But Kshatriya likes to fight in the sense he is very valiant and he fights with honor. That is his nature. And now to fight for religion is the ultimate perfection of this tendency. Fight for religion means we can either fight for our personal to establish our personal interest or gain, or we can fight for the sake of upholding dharma. Say for example, the Second World War was fought, a big war. Practically the whole world got involved. That's why it's called a world war. But was it a fight for religion? Fight for dharma? No. It was the fight for materialistic objective. Somebody wanted to have his kingdom spread far and wide. So he wanted to have, so he arranged this war, and it became bigger and bigger and bigger. So the purpose of that fight is not religious. But when somebody fights to establish dharma, establish religious principles, and that is called dharma yuddha. Now, Kurukshetra, battle of Kurukshetra was a dharma yuddha. It was arranged by Krishna himself. Because Krishna is the center of dharma. The laws given by the Lord is dharma. Religion ultimately means laws given, not I won't say ultimately, religion generally means laws given by the Lord. Now, now Lord himself is present. Although he is not fighting, but he is present in the battlefield. He is siding with the Pandavas. And Pandavas are fighting to establish Krishna's supremacy and authority. Therefore, this is a real dharma yuddha. So Krishna is pointing out to Arjuna that it is the ultimate perfection of your kshatriya hood that you got this opportunity to fight this battle. Not often such opportunities come by. Everybody do not get into a war for the sake of establishing dharma. But here, nobody can actually doubt that this was a dharma yuddha because Krishna himself is present in this battle. And Krishna is telling Arjuna that you are a kshatriya, your duty is to fight. And here is the opportunity to fight for the sake of establishing dharma. So why are you hesitating? Accept this opportunity. Yes, next.
Yadrishaya sopapanam svarjadharam apapritam sukhinam chakriya parta labhante yudham idrisham. O Partha, happy are the kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets.
So, Krishna is now explaining to Arjuna that why a kshatriya should be happy with such an opportunity. Why a kshatriya should be happy with such an opportunity? Because it is a if one dies, then he will go to heavenly planets in this battle. If he dies in this battle, he'll go to heavenly planets, and if he wins the battle, he'll enjoy the earth planet. The gateway to the heavenly planets opens up at a time like this, in a battle like this. Fighting opportunities come unsought. Arjuna did not want to fight, but by the development of incidences, it naturally came to a situation when this battle became inevitable. So he is telling Arjuna that, why are you hesitating? Why are you becoming bewildered? So take advantage of this opportunity. Next.
First, if a devotee could say fighting for the U.S. Army somewhere, and he dies in battle, would his prescribed purpose is that you should see your occupational duty as ordained by Krishna. He is working as a soldier in the army and he dies
Okay, good point. Now tell me, is there a Dharma Yuddha? The battle of Iraq? Is it a Dharma Yuddha? Who is on the side of Krishna? George Bush? Tell me. Or the Iraqis? None of them are actually fighting for establishing dharma or upholding dharma. So this is, George Bush wants the oil or gold, and Iraqis are trying to establish, keep their sovereignty, keep their freedom, keep their independence, and they're fighting. And then those soldiers are not really Kshatriyas. They're mercenaries. There's a difference between a mercenary and a soldier. Not a soldier, but say Kshatriya. What is mercenary? I'll explain, Ramkeshwar. Mercenary means a person who fights for money. He takes salary and he fights. Right? Kshatriya will never take salary. Kshatriya will always remain independent. The Brahmin, Kshatriya and Vaishya, they're always independent. Can you get a Vaishya or can you get a businessman to run a business for salary? If somebody, can you get a businessman to run a business for salary? He does it for his profit. He makes the profit. He doesn't depend upon somebody to give him the money. If he does that, that is the difference between a businessman and an employee in a business. There's a manager, he is running the business, but he is getting a salary. Do you call him a businessman? Do you? No. Why? He is running the business. He is running the business for his boss. Boss sleeps at home or travels around the world. And enjoying himself in his cruise ship and private jet. But this manager is running the business. Do you call that manager? Do you call the manager a businessman? Why not?
He's not the beneficiary of the business.
Yeah, right. He is not the one who is establish the business. He is doing it because he gets money. Right? So similarly, a Kshatriya, if he takes money, then he is not a Kshatriya. If a soldier, if a warrior takes money, then he is not a soldier. He is a mercenary. Hired fighters. So that's the difference between a Kshatriya. So these soldiers, those who are fighting for America, they are not soldiers, they are not Kshatriyas. You can't term them as Kshatriyas. They are mercenaries.
Maharaja, Krishna says that even if the mast is faulty, so wherever there is fire, there is smoke. So
what's that? I couldn't get that.
That in the 18th chapter, Krishna says that one's duty has to be performed, even though it's faulty. Wherever there's some fire, there'll be smoke. So wherever there's action, there'll be some fault. So if one is a devotee, naturally he may be working in a place that the boss may not, or in this case the army is not Dharma Yuddha. So if he dies in the performance of that duty.
Yeah. So don't try to understand the point that I'm making. When somebody takes money, he is not a Kshatriya. He is a Shudra. So what is his dharma? Can you call that it is his dharma to fight? Right, you got the point. So, and besides that, this battle is not Dharma Yuddha. So dying in this battle, first of all, they are not Kshatriyas and the war is not Dharma Yuddha. So if somebody dies in that battle, he doesn't go to heavenly planet, he becomes a ghost. Like Prabhupada said, in Europe was full of ghosts. When Prabhupada went there, he said, in Germany, even in England, place was full of ghosts. Why? Because all the soldiers that died in the war, they all became ghosts. Not all, most of them became ghosts. Yeah, as a servant, but servant of Maya. Right. They are Sudras and they are serving their master. Unfortunately, their master is not Krishna. So what will be the reward? Right?
I just want to clarify one
thing. Yeah, sure.
I don't need to offend anybody in the audience here, but I just want to apply this to someone who is a school teacher. Not just done school or anything, just a public school. Generally, that's the Brahmin's occupation, but a person is doing it for a salary. So, is he still Brahmin?
Okay. Anyone who takes salary is a Sudra. Alright? I mean, if we, as you said, like it may not sound nice, many people may feel offended, but the reality is that anyone, okay, let's put it this way. The Brahmanas will not take salary. Will a Brahmana take salary? Okay, now let's take it this way. There are many temples in America set up by Hindus. They get the Brahmanas, the Pandits, Pujaris from India, and they get some salary. Are they Brahmanas? Now, does it answer your question? The moment one takes salary, because the Brahmana, Kshatriya and Vaishya will not take salary. Taking employment under somebody means he is a Sudra. Brahmana, Kshatriya and Vaishyas are always independent. And in the age of Kali, the reality is practically everyone is a Sudra. Prabhupada is simply trying to make some Brahmanas in this age. ISKCON is the only institution that is making real Brahmanas out of the whole lot of Sudras. Yes, Chandrasekhar?
In some of our big temples in ISKCON, Pujaris and those who are performing Brahminical rites receive some sort of stipend or salary or allowance, however you want to call it. So what does that make them?
Yeah. You see, the Brahmanas do not get salary. But Brahmanas get donation. That's how they maintain themselves. So if somebody gives donation, that is, what they're doing is, as you said, giving allowance. To maintain your family, you need money. So the institution, the temple, is offering that money. That's all right.
Is there a difference?
Yes, there is a difference. Is there any difference between allowance and salary?
Well, if it comes at the end of the month in the form of a check, what's the difference?
Yes, but you see, they are doing it for the sake of the institution. They are not doing it for... They are not rendering devotional service for the money. They are doing whatever they are doing, they are doing it as a devotional service. And the institution is giving them maintenance. See the difference? An employee will take the job because of the salary. Whereas, somebody is doing something irrespective of whether he gets salary or not, but the institution is giving him the maintenance. Is there any difference? Like for example, you hire somebody, and he is getting X amount of money. If you don't give him the money, what will happen? 1 month probably he'll tolerate. 2 months he'll tolerate. And on the third month he'll take you to court. Right? Or he'll leave you. Go to some other place and find another job.
Is that the case of the devotees? Do the devotees think that way or behave that way? No. They are devotees. They have joined the movement not for salary. And they will continue to render service no matter what. But do the society have a responsibility to take care of them? As an institution, does ISKCON have a responsibility to take care of its members? Yeah. Like for example, the battle is being fought. Kurukshetra war is being fought. Like, do they need food? Who is supplying the food? Do the soldiers have to go and fend for themselves? No. The food is supplied by the king. Who is organizing the war? And for whom they are fighting? So the leader must arrange the facilities for the followers to render their service. If the leaders cannot do that, then their followers will not be able to render service properly. Right? So therefore, as an institution, ISKCON does have a responsibility to maintain its members. It may be easy to maintain the brahmacharis and sannyasis because they don't have any encumbrance. But when one becomes a householder, then the society, and if they have committed themselves completely to the institution, then the institutions do have the responsibility to maintain them. Alright? Otherwise we'll lose our members. As it is happening, and it's unfortunate. Devotees, when they get married, they have family, the society cannot take care of them, and so they eventually go away. Now, isn't it a loss? How much does it take to make one devotee? So after making them devotees, after receiving so much service from them for so many years, is it wise for us to lose them? Naturally not. Therefore, what we have to do? We have to provide for them. We have to make arrangements so that we can take care of them. Yes, Sucharya?
Lawrence, back to the question about the soldiers in the battlefield. Because Krishna is the benefactor and the well-wisher of all living entities, does he take into consideration the individual attitude of the person? Because George Bush may be in it for the oil, but many, like my own daughter, her rationale was that she was very disturbed that so many people were being slaughtered by Saddam, and also for the issue of homeland security because people were attacked in our nation. Therefore, these soldiers feel this commitment to go and protect the country. So is Krishna individually reciprocating with the attitude, or is it completely across board that because the leader, Bush, is out of this and everybody is not benefiting?
Okay, Krishna's question will be, are you fighting for me or are you fighting for George Bush?
But they believe in God, they just know it's Krishna.
They believe, but what is the foundation and authenticity of their belief?
But they're always praying, oh my God, help me. I mean, it's impersonal, but it's the name God.
But when somebody goes and gives them Bhagavad Gita and asks them to read it, they say, I don't have any time.
Except the part started last week.
Okay, somebody maybe. But generally, so the thing is, you see, Ravan's soldiers, or even say Duryodhana's soldiers, sided with Duryodhana for all good reasons, right? But does it? They are thinking that what they are doing is right. Does it make any difference in the actual context? There are two considerations, relative consideration and absolute consideration. The relative consideration is the materialistic, you know, morality and so forth. But the absolute consideration is Krishna consciousness. So Krishna will act only when there is this absolute consideration. Otherwise, Krishna will reward them if their intention is good and if they tried it. What they'll get is good karma. And as a result of good karma, they'll have some material enjoyment. But that's about all. Some punya. But the spiritual benefit will be derived only when it is Krishna conscious. Therefore, we have to ultimately decide these two things, two considerations, either for Krishna or not for Krishna. That is the ultimate choice. And a devotee will just take this consideration for Krishna and not for anybody else. And that's what Krishna is pointing out. Like from a moral consideration, Arjuna is right. My grandfather, my relatives, I shouldn't kill them. From the moral point of view, it was right. But from the absolute consideration, it was wrong. That's what Krishna is saying. You're a fool. Because you're stuck with the moral consideration. You're not taking the absolute consideration.
So Krishna does not respond to, "Oh my God." He basically just gets pious activity for taking shelter of God. But he wants the personal service of Krishna.
Okay, let's put it this way. Are they fighting for God or are they fighting for George Bush?
Well, Bush is paying them.
No, but who are they fighting for? They are thinking they are fighting for God, and Sudan, the Iraqis are thinking that they are fighting for Allah. Right? And these guys do not know who God is, and those guys do not know who Allah is. But they are fighting. So what will be the result? Yes? Yeah, that's very good, because a devotee always takes an opportunity to distribute Krishna consciousness. But then again, you see, from their point of view, we have to see how many of them are really accepting the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. She is doing her duty by giving them Bhagavad Gita, but did they accept the teachings? How many of them did? It's planting the seed and hope it didn't fall on dry rock. Yes, Sridhar, listen. Yeah, Prabhupada said that what he has done is 50%. And the remaining 50% is to establish Varnashram Dharma. Now, what Srila Prabhupada did, if we consider that Prabhupada has done 50%, to match what Prabhupada did, can you imagine the dimension of that? Right? Like what can you imagine what Prabhupada has done? Actually, we cannot imagine. In course of time, it will be unfolded.
what Prabhupada has done. So to match that act of Srila Prabhupada will be to establish Varnashram Dharma all over the world. That's what how we have to take it. And Prabhupada actually did say at one time that not that everybody will become devotees. ISKCON is for making devotees, but not that everybody will be a devotee. Most of them will not be devotees. Therefore, we need Varnashram, which means those who did not become devotees or those who will not become devotees, for them we need this Varnashram, a structure in the society where people will be able to act according to their propensity and influence of modes. Right. And another consideration is, you see, Varnashram and democracy are diametrically opposed. Right? Varnashram means division of the society according to one's nature. Isn't that Varnashram? Division of human society according to his inherent nature. Even if not inherent, at least apparent nature. Whereas democracy, anybody can do anything, anybody can say anything, anybody can get away with anything. Right? Now, can they exist side by side? No. A kshatriya, if he sees that something is wrong, he'll pull out his sword and chop his head off. First he'll warn him. If he doesn't listen, he'll chop his head off. Right? Or he'll challenge. Like when Parikshit Maharaj saw Kali torturing a cow, what did he do? He pulled out his sword and he was about to kill Kali. So that is a kshatriya. Now in today's world, you try to do that, what will happen? You will end up in prison. Right? So, there is no room for Varnashram in this democratic society, or which will eventually lead into socialistic or communistic society. Therefore, in order to establish Varnashram, we have to get rid of democracy. In a democratic world, you can't establish Varnashram. We have to get rid of democracy, and it's not an easy job. Varnashram is not a matter of just taking up a farm, right, and saying that you are Brahmin, you are a Kshatriya. It's not that. It's their nature that will become manifest, that will become enhanced. Right? And it will take time. It will take time. As I said, Varnashram cannot be established in democratic society, or a communistic society, or a socialistic society. And that is what today's world believes in. Right? Therefore, in order to establish Varnashram, we have to establish Varnashram. Only then Varnashram can be established. The Kshatriyas are going to rule. And their thing is, that might is right. More powerful one will prevail over the inferior ones. So apparently, it may sound like there will be total chaos, there will be total breakage of law and order. And then the Kshatriyas will establish, their supremacy, establish Krishna conscious society with Krishna in the center, where everybody will have his ability to function according to his nature. Okay, I'll take the next one. Yeah.
all matters, you know, where these kings play devil. Arjuna went to conquer, you know, the different kingdoms and to get some Lakshmi before they established the Indra-prastha. So, what about those battles? Would they be considered also as battles?
Okay, very good point. Very good point. That even if the thing is not apparently for Krishna, whether they are dharma yuddha. You see, Vedic society was basically founded on the Vedic scriptural injunctions. Everybody followed the Vedic tenets, Vedic teachings, and accordingly they used to function. Therefore, the structure was basically religious structure. That is one consideration. Another thing is that it is the law that has been, you know, it's a Vedic understanding. For a Kshatriya, might is right. The more powerful can prevail over the lesser one. That is the Kshatriya's standard. Right? And in the fight, if somebody who is less powerful stands up against a more powerful king, and if he dies, he goes to the heavenly planets. Because he is actually functioning with an understanding which is founded or based on the Vedas. And as a result of that, their character is to be very upright. They used to fight a fair battle. They wouldn't break the law. Like for example, they wouldn't hit below the belt. It was all the war, the laws of the standard of the war, or the rules of the war, was very clearly defined. And they all would follow that rule. So they all were very valiant individuals, and their character was very upright. And they would fight in such a way that they would actually transcend the bodily platform. A Kshatriya would not feel the pain in the body. What does it mean? He is not in a bodily platform. He doesn't feel the pain. His right hand is chopped off, he fights with his left hand. Totally unconcerned about what happened to his right hand. So when somebody is so heroic and so upright in his character, naturally he will be elevated to a higher situation. Yes, you have a question, Mataji? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, it seems that we're just having discussion. Okay. Okay, immediately the thought that came to my mind that with the war between US and Iraq, maybe US is winning because we are chanting Hare Krishna in America. Whereas in Iraq, no one is chanting Hare Krishna. That's why they're in a bad shape. Yes, wherever there is a chanting of the holy name of the Lord, that place becomes sanctified and glorified. I think in Bible there is a statement, I vaguely remember, that the Lord actually said that He did not destroy, I think, Gomorrah or Sodom and Gomorrah because there was a devotee there. Maybe, can you shed some light on this? Does anybody have any understanding? Like, so the. Huh?
One
saintly person. Right, right. So if there is one saintly person, he would not destroy that place. So now consider, there are so many saintly persons. And in India at that time, Prabhupada just went and started to chant the holy name. So obviously that created an inconceivable good fortune for that country. Well, if Prabhupada said that, if Prabhupada said it, then what can I say? Or if Prabhupada said it, what can I add to that? Yeah, sure. And that's how we have to look at it. And this is how a good fortune is being created for this world. Krishna, by this propagation of Krishna consciousness movement, the world is experiencing such inconceivable benefit. Like recently we had a GBC meeting here in this room only, and one GBC member actually asked a question, that what is the state of Krishna consciousness in America? Which actually meant, he tried to imply that, you know, Krishna consciousness is in such a bad state in America. The temples do not have enough devotees, and like somebody recently, not in a meeting, but just casually commented in a joking way, that in some temples there are more deities than devotees. But Badrinarayan Prabhu responded to that. He said, you go to America, so many people are becoming vegetarians. So many people are taking to yoga. So many people are accepting, showing their interest in spiritual life. How do you think that happened? It all happened because of ISKCON's propagation of Krishna consciousness. We may not directly see it, but this is the result of Krishna consciousness movement. 20 years, 30 years back, how many people were vegetarians in America? 20 years back, he was actually, Badrinarayan Prabhu was telling me that he told somebody that this is a book on yoga. And he said, oh, what? Yogurt? So, and then he mentioned that actually this here it speaks about vegetarianism. He said, is it a new political party? Is it a new political party? So this used to be the notion about yoga and vegetarianism. But today you look at it. Yoga has become a household word. Vegetarianism, practically every fourth person is a vegetarian today. So this is how this movement is having its influence. Okay, let's go to the next verse.
If, however, you do not perform your religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties and thus lose your reputation as a fighter.
So Krishna is telling Arjuna, if you don't fight, this will be the consequence. You will lose your reputation.
And for a Kshatriya, his reputation is very, very important. Kshatriyas are very proud people, naturally. By nature, they're, don't you see a lion? Isn't lion very proud? That is a Kshatriya. So you go and tell a lion that you are an ass, how will the lion behave? So that is how important the reputation of a Kshatriya is. And Krishna is pointing out that if you don't fight, you lose your reputation. And consider how painful it will be for you. Okay, next.
You should always speak of your intimate and for the respected person, dishonored words.
Yeah, so this is the point. For a Kshatriya, dishonor is worse than death. He would rather die, but he will not allow any infamy to come upon you, any dishonor to come upon him. So again, Krishna is emphasizing that point, that what will happen to your reputation, those great warriors, great generals, those who look up to you with such awe and reverence, they will think that you left the battlefield out of fear. Next. Your enemies will get a good opportunity to speak badly about you. And they'll scorn your ability. They'll despise. They will speak unfavorably about your ability. So what can be more painful to you than that? You are thinking that it's painful for you to kill your enemies? That's going to be even more painful, and you have to live with that pain throughout your life. So this is how Krishna is actually establishing the nature and character of a Kshatriya. Yes, so that is the ultimate consideration of this battle. So if you die in this battle, if you get into this fight, worst comes to worst, is you will die. And if you die, what will happen? You'll go to heavenly planets. And if you win the battle, then you will enjoy this earth planet. So it's for your benefit in either way. So get up with determination and fight. So in this way, Krishna is provoking Arjuna to fight, inspiring Arjuna to fight.
So Krishna is now, in this way, explaining to Arjuna about the benefit of fighting this war. Without considering your happiness or distress, your loss or gain, victory or defeat. Fight, just for the sake of fighting, because that's your dharma. And by so doing, you will never incur sin. If you become situated in your dharma, you do not incur sin. If you act on behalf of Krishna, you will not, what to speak of incurring sin, you will become free from your sinful reactions. Isn't it? So now Krishna is telling Arjuna that I have explained through analytical study, I have explained to you the difference between matter and spirit. And now listen as I explain it in terms of working without fruitive results. Working without fruitive results means that is called karma tyag. Acting for the sake of getting the results is called karma. Acting with an intention of offering the results to Krishna is called karma yoga. So when one acts in karma yoga, then he becomes free from the result of the reactions or karmic fruitive results. So Krishna is now telling, now I am going to explain to you about that. How to act in such a way that you will not incur the result of your action. Well, that is called karma yoga. So in this chapter, Krishna is explaining karma yoga from now on. In short, Krishna will explain the karma yoga, which is, when you act in such knowledge, you can free yourself from the bondage of these works. Generally what happens, our action or our works cause bondage. Karma fall cause our bondage to this material nature. Now Krishna is going to explain the art by which one can become free from the karmic reaction.
What was karma tyag?
Karma yoga is offering the results to Krishna. Now when one acts but without offering the results to Krishna, he tries to act, he stops to act. That is called karma tyag. He, like the yogis, try to do. Not work, not act. But Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that that's not possible. You cannot stop to act. Everybody has to act. You may not act with your body,
But your body, inside the body, so many actions are going on. You are breathing, your heart is pumping, you are digesting your food, all this work is going on. So how can you stop acting? So that doesn't work. Karma tag or renouncing of work is not practical.
The third one is just karma.
Huh?
And the third is just karma where you connect.
There are different stages. One is karma. One is karma yoga. When the result is offered to Krishna. So just acting is called karma. Then if you just act for, and then you become liable to the reactions. Action will produce reaction and you are responsible for the reaction. Good action will generate good reaction, punya. Bad actions will generate pap, sin. As a result of punya, you will enjoy. As a result of sin, you will suffer. So as one acts accordingly, he becomes liable to the reactions. But when one acts for Krishna, or rather when one offers the results of his action to Krishna, that is called karma yoga. But when one acts for Krishna, on behalf of Krishna, by the instruction of Krishna, that is called bhakti, devotional service. So that is the difference between karma yoga and bhakti. In karma yoga, you offer the results to Krishna, but in bhakti, you act on behalf of Krishna, for Krishna's pleasure.
What is the difference between karma and vikarma?
Yeah, the wrong action is called vikarma. The actions that are not to be done, that is called vikarma. And karma is the action that has been prescribed. So even if you get the results, say again, it is right. Karma means good karma, right action, and vikarma means wrong action. As a result of right action or actions according to scriptural injunction, there you get paiti or punya. And vikarma, when you act in a wrong way, you incur sin and suffer. Yeah. Go ahead. Okay. Next is? Okay. Right. So when you act, as it has been pointed out, without the action that will not generate any fruitive results, that is in devotional service, when you act in devotional service, then what will be the advantage? There is this action of devotion, these activities of devotional service, there is no loss or diminution. Whatever you do, it'll be there with you forever. And advancement in this path will protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. So what is the most dangerous type of fear?
Losing one's human form of life.
Okay,
But before that, even worse fear is the fear of death. The worst fear is the fear of death. Are you afraid of death? Everyone is afraid of dying. But when one acts on devotion, when one accepts devotional service, he conquers death. Therefore, he is not afraid of death anymore. Like, we can approach that point in various ways, from various points, various angles. Like, one angle I will approach. So now that we have discussed these first few verses from the second chapter, what did we understand? What has been the basic understanding? Who will answer my question? Yes? Very good. You are not this body. Who are you? Spirit soul. Does the spirit soul ever die? Who dies? The body dies, but you are not this body. Will you die? Will you be afraid of death? Okay. So didn't you conquer the fear of death already? Right? This is how a devotee is not afraid of death. He conquers the fear of death. So, svalpam appasya dharma. So, if you act on this path even a little bit, if you make a little advancement, you will overcome the fear of death. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that whatever service you have rendered to Krishna, there will not be any loss or any diminution. So now that you have rendered devotional service to Krishna, will you get the benefit of that devotional service? We'll answer this question. Yes, Ram Keshava? Yes. So what form of life will you get? You said the worst fear is the fear of losing the opportunity of human form. Right? So now that you have rendered devotional service to Krishna, what kind of body you'll have in your next life? At least a body in which you can render devotional service. Right? So that is another way you become free from the fear of death. Right? So it's just a little execution of devotional service can save us from the worst kind of fear. Very good. Vyavasayatmika buddhi. Resolute in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada has translated this word vyavasayatmika buddhi as resolute in Krishna consciousness. So, those who are on this path are resolute in purpose and their aim is one. What is that one aim? Krishna consciousness. But those who are not Krishna conscious, the intelligence of those who are irresolute is many branched. Their intelligence is not one pointed. Their intelligence is not focused. Their intelligence is many branched. Bahu shakha. Yes.
So, Veda Vada Rata Partha. Those who are just attached to the fruitive aspect of the Vedas or the Karmakanda or Karmakanda section of the Vedas, they are unintelligent. What is the actual purpose of the Vedas? The actual purpose of the Vedas is to reveal the identity of Krishna and engage one in the service of Krishna. But instead of getting that understanding, if somebody becomes attracted to the flowery words of the Vedas, Pushpitam Vacha. Pushpitam, Pushpa means flower, and Pushpita means flowery. What are those flowery words? The flowery words are the allurements of material sense gratification, allurement of enjoyment in the material nature. Do this and you will have this benefit. The Karmakanda section of the Vedas describe that. You want this? Okay. You act in, perform this sacrifice, you will get this. You want to become a king? Okay, perform this sacrifice, you will become a king. You want to become the king of the entire earth planet? Perform such and such sacrifices, you will become the king of the earth planet. You want to become the king of the heavenly planet? Perform this sacrifice so many times, you will become the king of heavenly planet. Now, apparently these are very, very alluring proposals, isn't it? Oh, I can become a king, so wonderful. Or I can become a billionaire, so wonderful. Let me just do this. But these are a hindrance towards our spiritual progress. So these are not the main objective of the Vedas, rather these are the hurdles put on the path of reaching our ultimate goal, that is Krishna consciousness. So Krishna is pointing out that who will get stuck in those aspects of the Vedic rituals? People with less intelligence. Less intelligent people will become attracted to those aspects of the Vedas. But the real intelligent person like you all, what will they do? They will just leave them behind and go to the main essence. And what is that essence? That has been described in the previous verse. The Vyavasayatmika Buddhi. What is the meaning of Vyavasayatmika Buddhi? Who remembers? Resolute in Krishna consciousness. So since you all have become so resolute, so determined and fixed up in Krishna consciousness, that shows that you all are very, very intelligent persons. You have understood the real purport, real essence and the purpose of the Vedas. Thank you. Yes? As I said, to put the hurdles, to see how sincere you are to get Krishna. Right? You see, when there is something very valuable, to see whether you are qualified to achieve that, sometimes you are put through certain tests. And if you fail, you don't get the main object. So these are the tests or the hurdles. A little practice of the Vedic culture will bring you some material benefit. And Maya will question, Maya will ask, so do you want this? Come, here is the lollipop. And if you go for the lollipop, then you'll miss out on the ripened fruit of the desire tree. Yes.
Okay. It's the same actually. You know, one aspect of Karmakanda is Upasana Kanda, which deals with the Upasana, worshipping. Right? Worshipping with fruitive result, worshipping for the sake of fruitive result, is Upasana. Karmakanda is different actions which may involve. It's all actually kind of interlinked. Karmakanda will describe various types of austerities, penances, sacrifices for the sake of getting material benefit. That is Karmakanda. And the section that deals with the worship, that is the Upasana Kanda. Well, if Vishnu worship, if one worships Vishnu for material benefit, then it is Upasana, then it is Karmakanda. Because what is the purpose of worshipping Vishnu? For our sense gratification or for Krishna's sense gratification? What's the purpose? Rishikena, Rishikesha, Shevanam, Bhakti, Ruchyate. Bhakti, devotional service, is when the senses are engaged in giving pleasure to the Lord of the senses. So that is what devotion is. But when worshipping the Lord for the gratification of our senses, that is karma kanda. That's karma. You see, those who still want to have sense gratification but rendering devotional service, because their, you know, bhavasayatmika buddhi did not develop properly, they didn't become fixed up in Krishna consciousness. You know, they may want, and if they want material enjoyment, then yes, they will get material enjoyment. And where do you get the best kind of material enjoyment? In heaven. So yes, they may get, but should we desire that? No. Okay. So who is next? Yeah, okay. Many questions are coming up. And let's see. Okay. But what is the next line? Tibrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. So they will, you know, doesn't matter with, you know, what is their desire. But if they are engaged in devotional service, those desires will disappear. And they will become fixed up in devotional service to Krishna. So even if you have material desire, doesn't matter, still surrender to Krishna. Like Prabhupada is saying, that even if you have material desire, there is no need to ask the demigods for that. Ask Krishna for that. Because you are asking Krishna, eventually you will develop your faith in Krishna. You may tell Krishna, Krishna give me this, Krishna gives you that. Then you say, Krishna give me that, Krishna gives you that. Then eventually you will think, Krishna has already given me so much, why do I have to separately ask for something? The most essential, most important things, Krishna has given us already. Krishna has given all those to us. Like, tell me, what can be more important than oxygen, air? Tell me, in our life, what can be more important than that? Now, do we have to perform any kind of karmakanda or any kind of rituals to get that? Do we even have to pay money for that? No. It's, we are getting it without even knowing about it, without even asking for it. So who made this arrangement? So since Krishna made all these arrangements for us, why should we go and ask Him for something else? Therefore, an intelligent thing to do is just surrender to Krishna. Like a good child, does he ask from the parents, give me this, give me that? No. But do the parents depend upon the child to ask him and then the child he'll give? No, the parents give the child whatever he needs. Even the child may not know what he needs, but the parents know, and accordingly they give them. Right? Therefore, a good child doesn't have to ask for anything. I'll take his question before.
Maharaj, you mentioned about the purpose of karmakanda is to see if a person is sincere about attaining Krishna. And I heard that there are 96% of Vedic literature is about karmakanda. It's a big thing. So I just like to know, is there any other purpose behind karmakanda? Why did it took so much time to compile karmakanda?
Yeah. You see, because it is material nature. It's material nature, and here practically everyone, at least 96% of the people, you know, are into sense gratification. Therefore, Vasudev took so much trouble to give them the sense gratification so that they can say, I had enough of it. And now let me go for Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada is saying, even if one follows the Vedic ritual, Vedic instruction, even in Karmakanda section, what to speak of karmakanda? I mean, the worst part of this thing is, worst aspect is actually worship in the mode of ignorance, like worshipping of Kali. Prabhupada said, even that is good, because they're following the Vedic path. And yeah, so gradually, if they keep on following, eventually they will come to the platform of Bhagavad Gita. Yes.
As we deliver karma kind for one's own benefit, how come in Hindu tradition Lakshmi, who is the goddess of fortune, is known as the goddess of wealth, and people without worshiping Vishnu, they just worship Lakshmi for wealth? Is that karma kind? I mean, she's the goddess of fortune. So how is that karma kind?
Yeah, yeah. If you want wealth, worship Lakshmi. Right? If you want money, worship Lakshmi. Right? You will get that. But when you get money, then what happens? You try to enjoy. But do you enjoy? You don't enjoy. Right? Whether you have money or whether you don't have money, you always suffer. So when you realize that this world is full of suffering, no matter how much I have, but still I am suffering, then you will come to the point to recognize, come to the point of questioning, now why am I suffering? Right? And if you come across the right instruction from the right scripture, then what will happen? At that point you'll come to recognize that you are suffering because you have rejected Krishna.
Generally we understand like Radha gives us mercy to attain Krishna. So in the concept of Vishnu, Lakshmi, how come she is known as just giving material wealth?
Yeah, that is the original Lakshmi Devi's expansion in the material nature.
Okay, so
she is more like a demigoddess. This Lakshmi is like a demigod who is in. See, demigods are in charge of different affairs of the material nature, right? Like in a government, there are different departments. There is education department, health department, etc., finance department.
So Lakshmi Devi is the in charge of the finance department. But that is the aspect of Lakshmi Devi in the material nature. Yes. Right. You see, not that all the people will be in the ultimate stage of spiritual understanding. Right? In the ultimate stage of spiritual understanding, one will want only Krishna. Now, if somebody is not in that stage, but he has some material motivation, so for them this kind of instructions have been given or information have been given. Like those benefits are not purely spiritual benefit. It has some, material tinge in it. Okay. He has his question, hands first, and then I'll take Siddhi Lalasa and then I'll take you.
You were talking about you said she's
the spiritual Lakshmi Devi in the spiritual sky.
Who is this Lakshmi?
Is Lakshmi, but she is functioning on this side of the material nature, right? Therefore, because she is not with Narayan in the spiritual sky, she is executing certain responsibility. She's doing it half-heartedly. She's thinking, when am I going to go back to Narayan? Right? Therefore, it is said that this Lakshmi is chanchala. She's fickle. She's unsteady. She may favor somebody, but that favor is not going to be long-lasting. Very soon that favor will be over. But Lakshmi with Krishna, Narayan, is achanchala. She's always there. So the point is, this material benefits are temporary, but spiritual benefits are permanent. As it has been saying, sarvam appasya dharmasya neha vikrama nasharasti pratyavayana vidyate. There is no loss or diminution. The spiritual activities, there is no loss or diminution. Whereas the material benefits are only temporary. Yes. Where? In Srimad Bhagavatam, where is the material benefit? Can you give an example? What kind of material benefit? Is it coming from Bhagavatam? No. Right. No, I mean these statements are not from Bhagavatam. Sometimes Bhagavat Mahatmya or stories relating to Bhagavatam may derive that kind of benefit, may speak about that kind of benefit. But in Bhagavatam, you don't get that kind of benefit, that kind of instructions. You get my point? Like in Bhagavatam, that's why I asked you, can you give any example where Bhagavatam is speaking about material benefit? That is Bhagavad Mahatmya, not Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, like there is another scripture that is glorifying Srimad Bhagavatam. There, that kind of instructions have been given.
But Srimad Bhagavatam is spotless Puran. There is no hanky panky allurements. Yes. Huh? Rajasri is there. Yeah, you see, they are functioning on the material platform in such a way to that it sets a proper example for everyone, right? So, as a king, one is expected to perform Rajasri Yajna to establish his sovereignty on this planet. So that is the process by which he did that. But those practices were for, or rather put it this way, that those practices are not prescribed for the age of Kali. In this age, only pure devotion. But because they were performing, like the society was Vedic, the general population were following the Vedic culture, therefore those Vedic activities, even though they are in the Karmakanda section, they were practiced. And you will see those activities, like these are activities which are very much the activities as a duty of a king. So dealing with the society, dealing with the population in a Vedic society, so they were essential. And that's why Krishna instructed them to perform Rajasri Yajna. Okay, so read the verse. So here it has been pointed out that those who are too attached to sense gratification, they cannot become a devotee of Krishna. The resolute determination for devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead does not take place. So what is Krishna pointing out? Krishna is pointing out that if you want to become a devotee, then you have to give up your desire for sense gratification. Krishna conscious and sense gratification are two opposite extremes. Either sense gratification or Krishna consciousness. Which means either you try to gratify your senses or you try to give pleasure to Krishna's senses. These are the two possibilities that we have. Now you decide which one do you want. How many of you want to gratify your senses? No one. How many of you want to gratify Krishna's senses, give pleasure to Krishna's senses? And those who are writing, what are they going to do? How many of you want to give pleasure to Krishna's senses? Naveen, what happened? You thought that I took it for granted? Yes?
Can you explain a little of the mechanics of how it is that sense gratification inhibits why devotional service does not take place?
Come again, I couldn't. Yeah.
Can you explain to the mechanics of how it is that sense gratification obstructs emotional service from taking place?
Sense gratification of?
From taking place. says here in Postal Service the Supreme Court does not take place due to sex gratification, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Explain a little bit how that is so.
Yeah. As I said, like, it's either or. So you have your body, your senses, your mind. It can either be engaged, these facilities, these faculties can be used or engaged either for your sense gratification, or you can engage them in Krishna's pleasure. Right? And there is a stage, actually, the initial stage, it is not that, you know, clearly apparent. Like, for example, initial stage, we are rendering devotional service. But it is not really purely for the sake of pleasing Krishna. There is some sort of fear involved, or obligations, a sense of duty, or even the desire that, you know, or even the expectation that if I do this, then I'll get some, you know, some benefits. So these are not pure devotional service. It's devotional service is mixed until it is completely free from the desire of sense gratification. But when we become, by rendering devotional service, when we become free from any intention of our sense gratification, then only it becomes pure devotional service. Right? So the point here is, like, as long as we have our tendency to gratify our senses, we will not be situated in the pure devotional place.
Is that because it's forcing, it's enhancing our identification with the body?
Yes, yes. Or our ability is as such, we can do only one thing at a time. Right? You have your hand. With this hand, you can lift this. Right? Now, if you want to accept that, then what you have to do is you have to drop this. Now, you don't want to drop it, so what you're doing? You're trying to not work. And finally, what you do is you drop this, then it's easy. You have lifted this up. So we have to uncondition our desire to gratify our senses. Right? We have to gradually come to the stage when we completely drop that. And then only we can accept Krishna consciousness.
People sometimes say that they can do both, but they're basically fooling themselves. Rationalization.
And we say good luck. And actually that's what happens, because that is the stage of mixed devotional service. Right? Devotional service has two stages, like mixed devotional service and pure devotional service. As long as we have this, you know, we are trying to do the balancing act, you know, it's mixed. But when we just give up one completely, then only we can take to pure devotional service. Last question. Oh, you're already running late. Keep it for the next session. Write it down. Okay.
I would like to ask a little more clarification about what is the meaning of sense gratification, because devotees, part of devotional service is to take prasadam, and taking prasadam involves the interactions of senses and the sense of.
Yeah. Once Prabhupada told me, make sure that the devotees get nice prasad. Because that's the only sense gratification they have. So yes, some sense gratification. Prasad, I mean, devotees are allowed to have some sense gratification. Like taking prasad.
But while we are taking prasad, we are gratifying our senses, but at the same time, we are deriving spiritual benefit. So that sense gratification is bona fide. Right?
Is there a necessity of attitude? Does attitude influence how we take prasadam, the spirit?
Yes, that's true. That's true. Initially, one takes prasad for his tongue, for his own taste. Right? But then gradually he realizes that this has been tasted by Krishna. Then he begins to try to experience or feel how Krishna tasted it. Right? And then finally he learns to receive the prasad as Krishna's mercy. So as he makes advancement, his consciousness is developed. Thank you. Okay, Manasu Chagri, I'll answer the last question.
In relation to Shakshana Prabhu's question, also in the story of Prithu Maharaj, Prabhupada writes in the purport that if one recites this three times before going to battle, he will always be victorious. And also, one will become the father of many sons, but also very qualified sons. So that seems to be a material benediction, but actually it's a benediction to help with one's service. Because it is a benediction.
What if he doesn't want many sons? Should he neglect that chapter? So we have to take the instructions in the right spirit, right understanding. We have to understand the Bhagavatam is simply giving us Krishna, is meant to give us Krishna prema, and no compromise. Hare Krishna, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Jai Shri Gaurakrishna. So, as I mentioned earlier, Mother Siddhi Lalasa will say something about some information from your handbook.
I won't take much time. There are so many questions that the devotees are asking, so just to help you use your handbook. So there are four handouts, four pages, and you can go through them. There are four pages. Some of you didn't get all the pages, but I hope you got these two, which give you the information how to use the handbook. So please read through them. There's one point here, it says 12 aims of systematic study. I was so much like enjoying this class with Maharaj and thinking that how we are very, very fortunate, extremely fortunate. Actually, we should thank Rara Sundari that she could get Maharaj to come for 1 week, 4 or 5 hours, spend with us. We are most fortunate. So we'll have a combination of the great souls and then here systematic study. So what we have here is the teachers of VIHE, MIHE, VTE. They came together and they put together here like a method of study of any of Prabhupada's books. It's not only this Bhagavad Gita, it's any book. So, and since like we underwent some training with the VG Rasamanda Prabhu and others, so we'll teach you how to study each verse and purport. So, you can go through your handbook using this as a guide. What I have here, see the handbook is quite bulky, there's so much information in it which you may not need. But I have written the page numbers where you can focus your attention. And when I start teaching, then we'll go through each of these aims, and I'll show you, you know, how to apply it. And I'd like to mention that you can see that there are three types of papers. You have paper one, which is closed book. That's going to be short question and answers. Like you have content-specific answers, questions. So that's the type of the closed book. Then the open book, just like I'm sitting here hearing Maharaj speak on different topics, and you are asking the questions. So what I'm doing, I'm writing the question for you on the spot, as I'm listening to Maharaj and all of you asking questions. So pay good attention to each other's questions and Maharaj answers, because you're going to write essays on those themes. You know, like we've discussed Varnashram, we discussed the soul, and then worship of Vishnu, Karmakand. So I'm not going to, you know, make you stretch your intelligence, imagination too much. I'm just taking inspiration from all of you and writing, formulating some question. So the answer has been given by Maharaj. So it's just a question of listening carefully, taking some notes, and then applying, like, I don't know what question will come up, how I formulate it, but you can use these points for your essays. So I'll explain further when... next week. So there's some verses. Okay, somebody asked about the verses, so it's there on the second page. Given the page numbers where the verses are situated, we found it. It's page 75 to 76. So there are two types of module. One is just a systematic study, and the other one is a thematic study. So a systematic study is when we go chapter by chapter, and the thematic module will be when we go across the book. Like we are studying, let's say, nature of the soul, but this is repeated in different chapters. So what we do is, if the thematic module is when you take a theme and you find all the verses in different chapters, and the chart is given in your book, which already gives the verse numbers. So the last three sessions of this course will do the thematic module, and then you'll take turns to present a theme. There are 16 themes. So each one of you will be assigned a particular theme, and you're going to give a class. So each one of you have opportunity to speak and share your understanding and realizations. So the assessment, so we have the topics on which you'll be tested. So if you could study before coming for class, meaning that you fill in the blanks in your worksheets, and then answer the questions in the handbook. So when you come here, you prepare. Actually, you've already read the purport, because we are not reading the purport when we come here. So that is done. When I will start, we'll go through the purport just to show you how to study. But depending on the interest of the devotees, we'll also be taking questions and we'll have discussions. So it's very important that you do the homework, because that's your reading. So you can go through this this paper, and if there is any question, you can ask me. And one thing is about how to analyze analogies. You'll be tested on analogies. It's very important for Bhakti Shastri. So we found that most devotees, for the exam, they don't do it so well. So I have made a sample, you know. So you can see how it's done, and we can practice together also. Actually, the explanation is given in the purport itself. All the points are taken from the purport. It's not that we have to imagine anything. Prabhupada already gives the explanation. But we need to understand how to apply it. And why analogies are important is because even you, when you're preaching, sometimes you say, for example, and then you give an example. You're bringing up your own analogies. So it's good for us to understand how to give an appropriate analogy. So that's all. If I wanted to see if there is any question. Yes. Yeah, we have to make some more copies. You ran. I don't know, somehow there were more devotees here. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna. We'll post the schedule for the course, you know, like who's teaching when and which chapters we're supposed to cover. I think we'll post it on the door. Actually, you're supposed to give you a copy, an individual copy, but I think we'll just post a copy on the door. Hare Krishna.